thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, Amanda French, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 67, recorded March 3rd, 2011. Get your Dan Brown ebooks here. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Digital Campus. As usual, we are joined by Dan Cohen, the director of the Center for History and New Media. Hi, Dan.
Hey there, Amanda. How are you doing?
I am well, thank you. I am
good.
Sad to be in CHNM North
right.
rather than down in Austin, Texas, where I was yesterday. But I'm going back to Austin soon. And I'm.
Oh, you'll be at South By?
I will be at South By, yeah.
And I'm
also going down for the TILTS. It's the Institute for Literary and Textual Studies at Texas. So that'll be fun.
Wow. Sounds great.
But continuing with the introductions, we have Tom Scheinfeld, Managing Director of the Center for History and New Media.
Hi, everybody.
How are you doing?
I'm good. Down at CHNM, I've moved officially full-time to Connecticut, but I'm down at the center this week and happy to be back.
More remote workers.
Yeah,
CHNM. Part of our CHNM yeah. North campus.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Mills Kelly, how are you
Hello.
Doing?
Hello, I'm doing just fine. I am actually at George Mason University.
One of the few.
Somebody has to be.
And I am Amanda French. I am also a cult follower of the Center for History and New Media, positioned more northward than others. And I'm particularly excited to welcome a guest to the Digital Campus podcast. We have with us today Audrey Waters, who writes for Read Write Web, a wonderful technology magazine/blog. Audrey, how are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here. This is exciting.
And we've just learned that you're physically located in San Francisco. Is that right?
At the moment, yes. At the moment.
We have I for one, I don't know about everybody else, but I have a very romantic view of San Francisco and the Bay Area and Silicon Valley. Is it everything that we imagine it is?
It is just as magical as Steve Jobs gets on stage and tells everyone. Indeed.
I'm so glad. I hate it when my illusions fall into flinders at my feet. So I'm glad to know.
So Audrey, does Amanda get a free T-shirt for saying "Read, Write, Web" correctly on the first try?
Ooh, you get one too, Dan.
She definitely should. Definitely.
I thought that's a website policy for your great blog.
Well, and I have to say, it is a great name for the blog, but I feel like now that CDs are becoming a little bit obsolete, people won't remember anymore. You know, the days of CDRWs versus CDRs. You know, I gave many lessons on that distinction back in the day. But
who knows? The web might be going away too. So Steve Jobs has his way.
Oh, really? Had not
That's
heard
right.
about that.
Read write apps.
Apps.
We'll have to buy that domain name now.
It's okay. Stick with it. We've stuck with new media for these 17 years, and at some point, it's like international business machines. You just get used to it.
Well, we have a great deal of news. We are recording this on Thursday, March 3rd, and it seems like the past two or three weeks have been chock full of interest. We actually want to hear first from Dan, who yesterday was at a very interesting meeting at Harvard about the Digital Public Library of America project. Dan, you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I'll try to be brief, but this is part of an ongoing initiative to launch some kind of, as the name suggests, a public library, it's really, I'm not sure of a couple of the words in the name, and those were discussed, the public part and also the America part, because obviously it would be a website or search engine that would cover digitized materials, not only for people in the United States, but abroad. But there was also, in some sense, an attempt to see what a public library would look like in the 21st century, including things like loaning books or ebooks. This took place at Harvard. I think some of the irony was not lost in the fact that we were at the Harvard Faculty Club discussing the Digital Public Library of America. And we were also operating under a cone of silence, or at least partial silence imposed upon us by the organizers, who used something that I'd never heard of before called the Chatham House Rule, which is a rule that they use at the Chatham House in London, where you're not supposed to attribute any comments to anyone. So you can actually tweet or blog from a session that is operating under the Chatham House Rule, but you're not allowed to say who said it. I violated my own Chatham House-ness by outing myself on my blog on Tuesday with what I said there. But I think I can understand why it was put in place. There were representatives from some large tech companies that I'm sure our readers can identify. You know, ones based on fruits and large numbers and things like that. And I think there was a feeling that if we didn't operate under some laws of secrecy, that maybe people wouldn't be able to speak honestly and also, frankly, commit, I guess, resources and time to the effort without feeling that they could sort of openly discuss it and not be held to certain commitments and comments. There were about 60 people there. It was supposed to be a slightly smaller meeting than that. I was fortunate to get an invite. And my role there was to represent what scholars would want out of a massive digital library. And so I think our audience can here start to imagine what you might have if you, let's say, combined Google Books, Google Scholar, and also, you know, other kinds of collections. The Smithsonian was represented at the meeting. I think it's okay to say that. And the Library of Congress was there as well. And material culture, other kinds of scanned objects other than books would certainly be included. And I think the closest thing we have worldwide is Europeana, if people have seen that website, which I believe we've discussed on the podcast before, which is a very large site based in Europe, funded by the EU, that aggregates really the entirety of digitized content from many national libraries and also museums and historical sites and other places. So I think that we were trying to conceive what this might look like. And basically, my summary would be that there were, I think, a few key issues that still need to be worked out. There was a lot of discussion about this public library, the publicness of it. And there were representatives of public libraries from around the nation there, and they were concerned that that word was used. They really see the public library as a place that's important in its physicality, that it serves communities, that it is a place where people can go for not just books, but internet access and you know, services that you can't get online. And so, you know, they're concerned that they wouldn't want something to replace, I suppose, that role. Then there was, again, the question of, you know, well, what is the public library of America? So what are we putting into this thing? And so another big tension was this question of centralization versus decentralization, is I guess how I'd put it. Is this thing, the DPLA, a meta search engine that sort of scans out over different collections the digitized content, let's say, of the University of Michigan and of the Smithsonian and of the Minnesota Historical Society all at once? Or is it something centralized where there'll be an organization, assume a nonprofit, that would spin lots of platters and on those digital platters would hold the aggregate contents of everything that's scanned by participating institutions? So that was a really big question. Finally, I think the third tension I saw was within the content. This was what they called day zero. So this was the first real meeting of stakeholders since the conception of the idea in the fall. And there were, of course, lawyers in the room, and there was a lot of discussion about what we called green, yellow, and red digital objects. So green objects were things like public domain books that we could scan and put online, no problem. We know how to do it. Google Books has done a lot of it. The Internet Archive has digitized a couple million public domain books. We know how to do it, but there's not a lot of, in some sense, bang for your buck if you want to be a public library, which generally circulates things like Dan Brown novels and Harlequin romances. Then there was the yellow material, which I sort of categorized as the 20th century, which is incredibly problematic because about two-thirds of what's been produced in the 20th century is under very shady copyright law, and it's hard to know how we'd ever really get this stuff online until the 22nd century. So much of it is what's called orphan works, works that are produced by people that we can't find them anymore, or the rights holders, so we don't really know what to do with that. And then there was the red stuff, which is stuff like the Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown's novel. It's the 21st century stuff is sort of how I wrote it down in my notebook, that it's stuff that actually a lot of, well over half of the circulating materials at public libraries are those kinds of, you know, 7-day or 2-week high rotation bestsellers, genre fiction, nonfiction, how-tos, things like that. And that stuff is also in a different kind of limbo than the orphan works of the 21st century, where, and this is really a remarkable part of the meeting, we heard that actually the big six publishers, there's really no amount that they will accept for an unencumbered ebook right now. In other words, of, let's say, a Dan Brown book. So there are platforms right now, one of them called Overdrive, for instance, that allows you to, a public library, to have ebooks, things that work on Kindles and iPads and so forth. And the way they do it is just like a physical book. You can check out an ebook, and then when you return it, someone else can check it out. But one copy at a time. But there, if we wanted to have a national digital public library that, let's say, has a copy of Dan Brown's book that could be read by more than one out of the 300 million Americans at one time, there's actually no amount that a publisher will currently take, this is my understanding of it, to actually get that copy, to get that one copy. So, you know, they're just so paranoid about destroying their sales that it's going to be really hard to work with this red zone, the 21st century material. So a lot to chew on. I think the project will go forward. I think the idea on the funding is that there'll be some foundations that will give it a kickoff funding probably this fall. So I actually think this is something that will really happen. And people in the room were very intent on making it happen. And then I think the long run sustainability model is likely to be based upon garnering some amount of the $3 to $4 billion a year that are spent by public libraries and university research libraries on acquisitions every year. It's a huge amount of money, and it's currently going to publishers or intermediaries. And so there was some thought near the end of the meeting of how you'd create a business model where you would try to reorient some of that $3 or $4 billion towards some of these purchases, if you could indeed get the purchases, as I said. I mean, if you can convince publishers to, for, let's say, one-tenth of that $3 billion, $300 million a year from public libraries, to get unencumbered ebook copies that don't explode upon their 26th reading.
So Dan, I have two questions about this that have, you know, popped into mind as you've been talking. I think you've answered the first one, and I guess take your word for it. I think we've all been to meetings like this where, you know, grand visions are espoused and nothing ever happens. But I'll take your word that this is serious and that this is going to happen. That was my first question. Is it actually going to come off? Okay. The second question, though, is how does this relate to, you know, the many actually other efforts that are, you know, pointing in a similar direction? Things like you know, the Internet Archive and the Open Library Project, things in fact like Google Books,
HathiTrust,
yes. Right. You know, all of those. I'm sure some of those people were probably represented at this meeting as well.
Yes.
I mean,
yeah.
Where, you know, does this become a replacement for those? Does it stand alongside those efforts?
Right.
I mean, is it where,
right,
where does it fit in the ecosystem?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I can't get into some of the specifics, but there were some versions of what was being tossed around whereby some of those very big collections that you're talking about might be, for instance, the seed for the Digital Public Library of America. I think that's a distinct possibility. Obviously, each one of them, with the exception of Open Library, which is run by the Internet Archive, are encumbered in certain sorts of ways. So, but there was a great deal of discussion about that. And of course, there are things like at the Library of Congress, they've been digitizing materials for almost two decades. And so there are, I think, foundations for this digital library. The problem was that, you know, what is the kind of content that the public would really want? And so when we think about some of those collections, let's say the Open Library at the Internet Archive, which has, again, about 2 million volumes, it's all public domain books, but it was kind of in that green zone that in some sense was really easy to do, but might not create a big splash to the public, and also might not put, I suppose, an entity into the world that would subsequently put pressure on, let's say, Congress to revise laws or to find ways around the existing laws. I think a lot of people felt it was very compelling to, for instance, have a website that would have a listing for an in-copyright book. So it would have all the, let's say, Dickens novels that have been digitized, and you could go and get them just as you can right now on Google Books or Internet Archive. But it would also have, let's say, a page for a 1950s book that would say, hey, we have a listing for this, but we can't give it to you because we can't find the author or the publisher, and the current regime doesn't allow us to show it to you. You know, I think that there will be, again, a seed collection. Which one of those things that you mentioned might serve as that? I have a decent idea what it could be, but I don't want to, you know, really say. Yeah. But I think that yes, there'll be some seed amount of a very large chunk of the green zone of the pre-1923 works, plus some other very obvious public domain works, let's say government works, anything that's been produced by the U.S. government, which actually a lot of people do go to public libraries for, government records and things like that. But then I think there's got to be significant work on both the yellow and the red zone, I think, to make it work. And I had the misfortune of having to give my little talk after a representative of a very large public library, and gave a very heartfelt plea about, you know, the kind of audience she serves. And then I sort of joked with the audience after she gave her talk that I felt now like I was standing up there in a top hat and with a monocle on. You know, it just it felt like, you know, well, I'd love Enlightenment documents to be in this archive for my research purposes, you know. And you realized how much of the circulating libraries of America are, you know, they are stuff that generally is in copyright. And so we do need to think about ways forward to encourage publishers and rights holders to contribute to this as well. And I think that's where the real sticking point is right now.
Right. And it's not just the publishers. I mean, I can't imagine that Jeff Bezos and Steve Jobs would be very enthusiastic about this. You know,
right.
You're selling ebooks right now, and if I can get them on my Kindle, the same exact book for free.
That's right.
You know, instantly. I mean, the problem, you know, the reason why I can imagine like a bookstore doesn't mind the competition from the public library is that, well, it's kind of a pain to check things out from the public library. It might not always be there. Like, you have to bring it back in a certain amount of time. You get late fees, all of that. So you buy the book. If it's, you know, if it's a paperback, it's $10 and you buy it, and that's that. But this, if this is available on my Kindle or available on my iPad, it's not really any more difficult to get it or to return it or to do anything with it than it would be to buy it. And so I can imagine, you know, you're going to have not just the publishers against this, but the booksellers, and that creates a pretty huge lobby, an influential lobby, I imagine, against changing any copyright laws.
Right. I think there was a real sense in the room that, and frankly, a slightly scary sense that publishers view this new world with these ebooks as, in some sense, a chance of a redo on the whole library thing, on the whole public library thing. I mean, if you think about it, what Carnegie did 100 years ago is rather unusual, that he provided these building funds and that then the communities would have to come up with sustainability models to fill them. But, you know, I think the publishers see this as a chance to grab back a lot of what they gave up with the public library world. And so there's a lot of talk about in some ways vocalizing the fact that public libraries actually are really good for publishers and authors. They, you know, a lot of people who go to public libraries and check out books, they, you know, then they want to go to the bookstore and get the latest version, often because they, you know, there's 39 holds at my local library here in Fairfax to get Dan Brown's latest book. So, you know, I think that there's going to be a lot of work on, I suppose, the kind of marketing side and the business model side to convince all these different players to play along.
Well, I am Dan. Thank you so much for that. I find this fascinating, and I had actually been talking about it yesterday in Austin as well. And you know, I've learned some facts. You know, I mean, first of all, libraries apparently account for about 10 or 12% of all books bought, roughly, print books, and you know, so that's a significant market for publishers. But at the same time, I think you're really right that publishers don't necessarily see that as, you know, a market share they want to keep and make happy, because they think that that can probably be converted to sales instead. Right. And they may not be wrong, particularly if, you know, in the case of ebooks, if the ebooks are cheaper than the print books were. I do think that it's... if there were a really easy way to borrow an ebook from a library, you know, I think it might cut back on piracy. You never know. Apparently, books are increasingly being pirated, but you know, that's going to take some research to find out whether that might be the case, and it might not, honestly, too. You know. Right. But yeah, I think I've heard people say before that you would never get the concept of a library past today, you know, the notion that there could be free access to, yeah, I mean, just entertainment books. I mean, we often, the rhetoric is a lot about an informed citizenry, but honestly, it's not always about that. It is about the latest Dan Brown book, and it is about Harlequin romances. And although I can definitely make very strong arguments for the educational purpose of entertainment reading, you know, I understand why in fiscally difficult times, people don't necessarily want to fund that. And as a result, public libraries are getting defunded right, left, and center. Anyway, it's a huge tangle. Before we move on to all the other news we have, I actually wouldn't mind hearing from Audrey about what your take on this is, as somebody who's not sort of in the higher education nonprofit world on a daily basis. Do you think we need a national digital public library of this kind?
I definitely think we do. I mean, and I think, although I'm certainly not sort of in academia any longer, I think that, you know, my background is certainly there. What fascinates me is watching some of these events unfold in the past week or so, particularly around HarperCollins, is precisely what Dan was saying. I think is that we really are seeing publishers, work hard to undermine the availability of ebooks at libraries, and I have to even wonder what that's going to look like at a consumer level as well. And as far, you know, as far as checking out books online, even though they are available now, it's a very unpleasant and difficult process. I mean, you know, checking out a book from OverDrive, for example, it's not at all the one click and your Kindle magically has, your latest novel on it. It's a multi-step process, and I do have to wonder how many people would opt to choose to download books via BitTorrents, because that is a far easier way to get your content delivered.
I also wonder too, somebody mentioned to me, I actually can't remember which country it is, that actually has a real culture of book rental, which we have only a tiny bit in this country, really, at libraries. You know, often that new Dan Brown novel comes in, and libraries will charge a small fee for it, as they do for DVDs and things like that too. But but apparently, I think this was in Asia somewhere. They don't have public libraries in the way that we do, but they do have a lot of book rental things. And I wonder if that might not be a viable alternative that would keep publishers happy and keep those of us who think that people should have the right to at least very inexpensive entertainment and information, if not free information.
I think that's a fail for the reasons that Audrey just described, because people are so used to getting things for free now online. And, you know, I've noticed increasingly if you search for things, you often, you know, things that are in copyright like that, you often will find, like the name of a movie, for instance, you will often, one of the early hits in Google will be the torrent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the average person doesn't know how to do that, but that's, you know, the average person didn't know how to send an email 15 years ago. So I think that increasingly the attempt to control with software like OverDrive or, you know, rights management software like that is going to backfire, because if, let's say that, you know, so HarperCollins recently said there's a 26 loans per ebook. Well, if we're talking Dan Brown, since we've been saying his books are incredibly popular, that will take approximately 1.8 seconds for those 26 to have been used up. And so that's just a completely non-functional model in the world that we live in right now. And so to think that that's going to be a functional model is just crazy. And people are going to start working around it for sure.
Yeah.
I think that just as you said, I mean, I was surprised. There were a couple presentations that just talked about how fast the switchover has been to digital reading from paper reading. And there was one chart that was really shocking just about the number of mobile devices and then also the surging, what will be in the next few years, the surge of you know, iPad-like devices, and I'm sure we'll get to that momentarily. But I was really surprised, actually, talking to a lot of the public librarians across the nation, just how fast that this has happened, too, in their mind, too. They're saying, you know, they've got truckers coming in with their Kindle saying, well, I've got this Kindle now. You know, I want to read on that. Where, how do I get books onto that? Mm-hmm. And so I think in the next few years, we're going to see this very fast shift. And, you know, I think the libraries are getting caught off guard a bit. And OverDrive is just a partial solution. So I think there was a real feeling that this Digital Public Library of America, as a kind of advocacy group, could find some way out of that thicket.
That's what I have to wonder about what you were saying earlier about actually, you know, this difference between the red light, the yellow light, and the green light is also just raising this general level of awareness about what copyright law is and how it works. Because I find that I don't really think people understand those sorts of things. And I think, you know, as a reminder to people about the things that we do have to advocate for in terms of access to information.
Yeah, and I'll mention that, you know, there are a couple of existing advocacy groups for specifically public libraries, because as many people have pointed out, this DPLA initiative is a Berkman Center initiative. It's one that was certainly begun by academic librarians and academics and foundation officials and people like that. But they're librarycity.org and libraryrenewal.org are both organizations that have been working very hard on this problem of keeping libraries relevant in the age of digital content.
Right. You know, just one last word on that, Amanda, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to take the last word on it. I thought your comment was a good one, but just a sort of details angle on this is actually when you talk to the OverDrive folks, what they say the issue is, and this is true for a lot of 20th century material too, but just on sticking with the Dan Brown stuff, is that you often have to deal not just with the publisher, but with the agent and the author for this stuff. So there's this like four-way negotiation of like who's getting what amount of money. And so actually just a lot of this is just the like painful book by book, author by author negotiation of like what gets into where, when, at what window do they get. And like you said, as long as the market, the public library market is only 10%, which is the number I heard too, you know, they're still going to be worried about fulfillment to your Costco's and your Walmart's and your Amazon's first. So it's a really difficult environment. And I was, for one, glad to see some pretty high powered, you know, name brand lawyers in the room as well. So I think that there will be some movement on that front.
Well, and I need to stop talking about this and move on, but I have to say that I think that, you know, it's going to be really difficult to do this in a way that'll be really useful for consumers unless we get some laws changed. You know, I mean, I just really think that without some, you know, without, it's the national part of the title that you know, sort of rings my bells. You know, it's like, how national can this really be if it's being done outside the purview of federal government, you know? And I was doing some research on, for instance, the National Library of Norway, and they digitized a bunch of stuff in Norway and started a huge huge program. And one of the, and because they had the sort of full support of the Norwegian government, they you know, managed to get some laws changed that allowed them to do collective agreements, essentially, with the equivalent of the Authors Guild there. And I mean, it sounded like a really good solution, to the point where they were able to put up. They did books from the 1790s, the 1890s, and the 1990s. Of course, you know, we're sort of like, well, most of those from the 1790s and 1890s were out of copyright, but the ones from 1990s were in copyright. But they, you know, because they had this kind of collective agreement, they were able to say, okay, well, we're going to make, you know, every book from the 1990s available for free for essentially digital checkout for a limited period of time. You know, and then after that limited period of time, those digital books will, you know, again, go back behind a paywall, essentially. And it was fascinating to me that there are countries that can get that done.
Mm.
All right, moving on. Speaking of e-reading devices, we saw this week the announcement of the iPad 2. Tom, I think you have some things to say about that.
Me?
Yes.
About the iPad?
Yes.
I guess I do. I'm actually probably going to get one of these things. It pains me. It is a very nice device, and the couple of features that they've added, I think the fact that it's a little bit thinner, a teeny bit lighter. It has the front and rear cameras. I think, you know, that sort of puts me over the edge, and I'll probably get one. I have to say I did also buy a Kindle in the last couple of months, and I've been reading a ton on it. So I don't think I'll probably use it for ebooks because I really do like the experience on the Kindle. But I think for that other computer that I use, you know, in the evenings in front of the TV to answer stray emails and things, and read blogs and other things, I'll probably use it for that. Here's the other thing I will say about it, though. You know, I think for the first time, though, Apple might be a little bit behind the curve on this. I was interested to see that there's not a lot of innovation in this device. Whereas you look at something like, I think the price point is looking pretty good at this point compared to some of the Android tablets that are hitting the market now. But you look at what's in the new Android 3.0 operating system, that sort of seems like where the innovation's happening. I mean, if you look at the Motorola Zoom, which also came out recently, if you go to a Verizon store and see one of those things, they've done a lot of things with the interface, for really customizing it to a tablet experience with home screen widgets and other things. Whereas the iPad is now starting to look a little bit like a big blown up iPhone, which is what it really was. And I'm hoping, and I for the sake of competition in the marketplace and everything else, and if I do buy one of these things, that in the next version of iOS we see some more effort put into the tablet specific OS as opposed to just, you know, a little phone and a big phone. So I think there's some really interesting things going on with the tablet market still. I think, you know, this is something we still have to continue to watch. But I really do think that the Android space, the Android devices are catching up in important ways and in some ways surpassing what Apple's doing.
Would you agree with that, Audrey?
I'm not sure I agree with that. And I think that the winning thing that Apple has in its corner right now is this third-party app ecosystem. And I'm just not sure. I mean, and I think that that was sort of the difference we saw in history, sort of with the Android versus Android phone versus the iPhone, is that you actually have to have this certain number of apps for people to be able to download before they sort of feel like an idiot for sitting with a device that might have, it might have all the sort of internal bells and whistles. It might have a better graphics card. It might have more memory. But that if you can't actually, you know, play Angry Birds, that's maybe not the best, most, that's not the best example. But if you can't access sort of the cool apps, then folks won't want it. I do agree, though, that I was less than impressed, or I guess I was not surprised with what Apple announced yesterday. But what sort of rhetorically what I was interesting and what I can't help but think of is that they're actually making this pitch as in some ways an educational tool. There were several videos that featured students. There was sort of showcasing the bookstore, the announcement that Random House had just agreed to their terms and conditions to get their Dan Brown books, I believe, in the iBookstore. And I can't help but think that that's what Apple sort of was making a play for. They rolled out a new page yesterday on their website appealing to schools as well. And I have to wonder if people who are sort of waiting for a better Android tablet for procurement for, you know, for the fall or for thinking about sort of tablet programs, I have to wonder if Apple just wanted to make a pitch to those folks saying, no, really, don't wait for Android. We can meet your students' needs now because we have two cameras.
That's interesting. And Random House. We heard in the last couple weeks, too, that there was this planned tablet device that was going to be aimed specifically at students. It was called the KNO, K-N-O, and that got canceled this week. And I wonder maybe they got wind of Apple's, you know, decision to try to focus specifically on that education market. So maybe that's why that died.
Yeah, I don't see the Android tablets beating the iPad in the next 3 months, 6 months, maybe. But I just think that we're seeing the announcement was everything we expected, but it was nothing we didn't expect. It was sort of underwhelming, whereas it seems like the energy is in the Android space right now. And so what we see 6 months out, I just wonder, I hope that Apple sort of seizes back that initiative. I mean, they've had this marketplace to themselves for a year. And I just hope they don't rest on their laurels. The other thing I'll say about this Android, you know, iOS business is my wife just took a new job and she had a phone with her old job that they, of course, took back. So she had to get a new phone. And so I'm a T-Mobile customer. And so she was, you know, just going to jump on my plan. So we went into the T-Mobile store to get her a new phone. And it happened to be this weekend where they were giving away all of their smartphones. Like, you could get any smartphone with a new contract for free. And so we went in there, and because I was making a change to my plan, I had to, like, you know, re-up, basically. I walked out of there with a brand new $500 Samsung Galaxy S for free. We both did. You know, when that's the proposition where it's, you know, the Android thing is free and the iPhone thing is $300. It's hard for me to see how Apple continues to have the kind of market share that it does now. And I think that's going to translate into right now. I think, you know, the Android tablets are way too expensive. The Zoom is like $800 or something, but that's going to trickle down into the tablet space too, where you're going to get the tablet essentially for free. And it just puts a lot of pressure. It makes things interesting, I think.
But we will continue.
Well, I will say though that I'm convinced now. I'm glad I didn't buy the first iPad, and I will be going out to buy the second one. And part of it is what Audrey mentioned, which is the targeting at educators. Because what I've been looking into is I could finally, you know, the older ones were a little harder to take into the classrooms here and use, but the newer ones appear to be much easier to use in that way. So that's what's finally pushed me over the edge, so I don't have to lug my laptop around anymore.
You know, I thought, Audrey, your piece on Read, Write, Web, yes, second T-shirt of the day.
Good job.
Gosh, maybe I'll get a baseball cap for that one. I thought was really good. I mean, I agree that I think it's actually very compelling for the classroom. I was up at UPenn last week, and they have a kind of a media lab that's got a lot of different things. They've got you know, Macs and Dells that you can do video editing on, and video cameras and green screens, and just a whole bunch of stuff that so college students can kind of muck around with the stuff and learn things. And I got to say, looking around that room, there were a lot of people working on like GarageBand and some of these kind of creative Mac apps. And I thought, I know they spent a lot of time yesterday talking about iMovie and GarageBand for the iPad. I think that kind of software is really going to distinguish it. I mean, first of all, the hardware is very sexy. And I actually think the Android tablets are going to have a hard time beating just the price beauty combination of the iPad for quite a while, unless they do it through these subsidies for monthly fees. But a lot of college students don't want to pay $20 or $40 a month to have a device. They already have a cell phone bill. But anyway, beyond that, I thought showing off something like GarageBand, I could totally see Penn buying 10 or 20 of these iPads just for the GarageBand experience for people who want to play around with music. I think, you know, so I think it's not a completely empty slogan that Jobs continually harps on this, you know, intersection of technology and liberal arts. I think actually he's seen it that way for the past 35 years at Apple. And I think he's just excited to get to a point where he's got a device that does that.
Well, I hope the liberal arts in general doesn't get the reputation that Apple sometimes has for being a rather bossy organization in terms of what it allows people to do and not do with its products. But we will continue to watch that and see how it
Well, that, I mean, that's the other thing that really interests me too is that, and I mentioned this in my article yesterday, is that that these are consumer electronics. And so what does it mean when we're putting in the hands of students a device that's really based on your own account with iTunes and your own personal computing device? That's a great thing on one hand, but it raises a lot of questions in terms of sharing and sort of the ways in which the models that we have often had for distributing textbooks and distributing other sort of other software, for example. So I'm interested to see sort of how iPads play out in schools.
Great. Well, we have in other sort of big technology company news, at the TED conference, Bill Gates recently sort of made a huge celebrity out of a history professor in Australia. Mills, you want to tell us a little bit about this story? You have a personal connection to it as well.
Well, a future personal connection, really, because I hope to meet David Christian when I'm in Australia later this year. But so David Christian, then a professor at San Diego State, was you know, presenting at a TED Talk and at one of the TED conferences, and about his course called Big History. It's one of these sort of, it's taking really the biggest possible framework for human history, as opposed to micro history and at the other end of the spectrum. And Gates was there and was incredibly impressed by this and decided to then pour some money into it. And so now all of a sudden, you know, we see just yet another example. Well, maybe it's not all of a sudden, but we see another example of the Gates Foundation, in this case, sort of direct intervention by Bill Gates himself, into the higher education space. I'm glad it was a history professor who got this kind of intervention. But to me, this is a really positive development because, you know, the Gates Foundation has a lot of money to spend on education. We talked about this in a previous podcast. And, you know, people can decide for themselves whether this was the right way to do it or not, but the fact remains it's his money. And I think that, you know, big money often draws more big money along with it. And so the kind of playing around with the ways that higher education innovation can be funded is really, I think it's really a positive development. Gates also had a very interesting piece, an op-ed piece in the Washington Post in the last few days about reforming higher education, reforming education generally. And, you know, he's focusing his rather considerable experiences and intellect on, you know, some pretty pressing problems of education reform and bringing an outsider's perspective to it, which I think is really, you know, worthwhile. I, over the years, as my wife will be more than happy to say, I've been a big critic of Gates, but I've really kind of stepped back from a lot of that criticism at the moment because I think he's, you know, with the foundation's funding of health issues around the world and but also, you know, now in education generally, it's just been a really positive development. So, you know, it's a very small story that one historian got some money to have this course of his, you know, broadcast around the world so easily, but it's an indicator of what's clearly an emphasis for Gates and his foundation, and I think that's really good for education generally.
I have to agree, but I was conscious of feeling a bit taken aback when I was watching Bill Gates, you know, the Gates notes about this, in which Bill Gates described this story. Apparently, he was listening to the lecture like on the treadmill, and that's where he had first heard about this and sort of became essentially took this course, you know, and via various, you know, already existing online means. And it really did kind of shock me. I was like, "Whoa!" Basically, Bill Gates just decided he liked this guy and then, you know, has the money and the connections to spread this course all around the world for free, you know, and it kind of gives you pause about, you know, just the amount of influence he has. It's actually not dissimilar to Andrew Carnegie, who we brought up earlier. You know, I mean, Andrew Carnegie kind of single-handedly back in the mid-19th century, you could argue, created the public library system that we have today just because he was, you know, had so much money and was a philanthropist.
It's good to be the richest man in the world. I mean,
yeah.
And Bill, if you're on the Stairmaster right now, listening to Digital Campus, you know, the five of us would like to say that we could definitely use $20 million.
Well, I was going to say $500 sponsorships are available for that camp.
That camp also.
And in fact,
come on, Amanda, think big.
I will even retract what I said about buying an iPad. How about that? I will say that.
Windows tablet.
Right, exactly. I will switch for that $20 million gift. So, I have some personal experience of working with a similar philanthropist in an NGO that I used to help direct, you know, George Soros, who funds things in very similar ways. And some people see this as very capricious and kind of, you know, shooting from the hip about where, you know, where he's going to spend his money. Well, first of all, the fact is it is his money and it's being spent on, you know, in Soros's case, he spent it on, you know, trying to create open and democratic societies around the world. And
bastard.
I know. Can you believe that? What chutzpah? But anyway, the thing, his basic strategy, if you look at his funding strategies over the years, was to just spread his money very broadly, knowing that a certain amount of it was either going to be stolen or just badly spent, but that also a lot of it, if it was given to bright people, was going and committed people, was going to result in some really good outcomes. And that's the strategy that works when you're a billionaire. It's a strategy that doesn't work if you're a $50 million foundation. And so,
right.
And so I think it's you know, for the mega philanthropist, I think it's actually a very functional strategy. I mean, it is in many ways what Carnegie and others did back in the old days. And so I'm not opposed to that kind of strategy. I mean, there are those who would love to manage very directly the way that these, you know, hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars get spread around. But I don't think that that's necessarily required.
Well,
and it can't be anyway because it's their money and they're going to do with it what they want.
Well, supposing that Bill Gates does slip the Center for History and New Media some money under the table for nefarious purposes, that we may be disinclined to fall into that kind of corruption now that we have the existence of UniLeaks, a site based on WikiLeaks for exposing various scandals about higher education. Has anyone followed this story at all closely? Want to tell us what UniLeaks is?
I've been following the story. Obviously, in the technology world, we've been following the WikiLeaks story rather closely. And there have been a number of, I guess, copycat whistleblower sites. And I was fascinated. There was a story in the Chronicle a couple weeks ago about this. It's an Australian website. And I believe as it stands currently, there are quite a few leaks leaks based on higher ed in Australia, but nothing yet. No secrets about American universities, but it's a site for to publish, you know, your university's secrets, to expose the, you know, to shed light on untoward things happening on campus.
My feeling on this is, it could be interesting if it's used for, you know, sort of real transparency to expose, you know, things that are you know, really problematic. The worry is that it becomes, what was that? You know, like that, it becomes like Juicy Campus or something. Whereas,
remember Juicy Campus? Rate my professor.
Yeah, remember Juicy Campus? You know, like
who's my student?
You know, that kind of stuff. You know, then it's less interesting. But you know, it could be if it's used in the right way. It could be. You know, I think just like WikiLeaks. You know, there's a lot of bad about WikiLeaks, and there's a lot of good about WikiLeaks, and it probably could serve a similar role. But I worry that it's either, you know, not really going to take off, or it's just going to be Juicy Campus all over again.
It made me wonder if I knew of any scandals about higher education. I mean, as long as I've been in it, you'd think I would know some, but nothing really occurred to me. Maybe I just haven't ascended into the hierarchy.
Yeah, we're pretty boring folks, too. I mean, that's the other problem.
Yeah. I couldn't help but think that a lot of the scandals would be associated. I mean, and this is, you know, having done graduate work at the University of Oregon, my apologies to my alma mater, I couldn't help but think that a number of scandals would involve sports programs. So it might not actually shed light on sort of the academic side of things, but maybe that's just, not that there aren't unfortunate events there, but I just couldn't help but wonder that's where my mind went as far as scandals.
I guess that's where the money is. So that's, you know, there's like with recruiting scandals and things like that. I could definitely see that.
Yeah,
or
I mean, there has
angry PhD students. I suppose we probably are.
There has been that, you know, the Jobs Wiki, the History Jobs Wiki. I guess it's actually all fields now that kind of gives the inside dope on how searches are going and things like that. That's I suppose function in some of the same ways, but. You know, and I suppose, Audrey, is it your sense they set this up probably not for the sports, but for the fact that there's kind of Armageddon in terms of funding for higher ed, and that they wanted a place for, you know, I don't know, administration documents showing big cuts about to come or something like that?
Right. I mean, that's my understanding, is that it's definitely about sort of the funding issues and just, I think, internal politics, if you will, that happen at the administration level on campuses. Perhaps
there doesn't seem to be much in the database at the moment.
No, and that's what I don't know as well. What they're doing in order to actually sort of I mean that's one thing. You get the whistleblowing, but then you have to go through and sort of verify or redact, and there's these other steps that I'm not quite clear what this site is doing before they throw information up online. Perhaps that's the holdup. There's all these secrets, and someone's carefully going through to verify. I don't know.
Probably not. Well, we've had a rather long digital campus today. Lots to discuss, lots to continue to keep an eye on. Thank you so much for joining us, Audrey.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah,
great.
Thanks, Audrey.
Great to have you on.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back sometime. But meanwhile, we hope that all of you out there in online land will join us next time for another edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself, fear itself, fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
Fear itself.
I think we should get a little raunchy.
Universities are just boring.